Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. I'm Jamie Floyd in for Brian Lehrer. In the early years of the war in Iraq, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of al-Qaeda in Iraq, was the top of the U.S. military's most wanted list. Although harsh interrogation techniques were used on al-Zarqawi's associates, it didn't lead to his capture. After the Abu Ghraib scandal, the U.S. military realized it needed a different approach. Matthew Alexander, a 14-year veteran of the Air Force, was sent to Iraq to usher in the new brand of interrogation, which he claims is what led to the successful elimination of al-Zarqawi. To explain what this new brand of interrogation is and why it works is Matthew Alexander, which is not his real name. He's the author of the new book, How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Used Brains, Not Brutality, to Take Down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. We'll also get his take on the Senate Armed Services report released yesterday, revealing that it wasn't just a few bad apples, but rather high-level officials, including former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld, that allowed the harsh interrogation tactics used at Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib. Performance artist Coco Fusco, who has investigated interrogation through a different lens, will also join us later. Matthew, welcome to WNYC.
Thank you for having me.
So first up, what do you make of the bipartisan report released yesterday by the Senate Armed Services Committee revealing that high-level officials in the Bush administration encouraged the use of these tactics, which are based on torture techniques?
Well, I think it has far-reaching effects. I find it a fairly accurate report, but I want to point out that the effects of the policy didn't stop when the policy stopped at Guantanamo Bay. For me, I tell the stories in my book about how I had interrogators who had come from Guantanamo Bay or who had worked as interrogators in the early days of Afghanistan and Iraq when the gloves were off. And these interrogators, even though they were now made to play by the rules, consistently had an attitude that they were allowed to use approaches for interrogation based on fear and control. They just had to keep them within the rules, and it was extremely counterproductive to what we were trying to accomplish.
And the report reveals that it wasn't just a few bad apples, as the Bush administration asserted back when the Abu Ghraib scandal broke. But it sounds, Matthew, as though you are not surprised at all by the report.
I'm not surprised at all, no. I don't think that it's a few bad apples, nor do I think that on the other extreme that it's a large majority of interrogators. The large majority of interrogators do the right thing and do conduct interrogations ethically, but it's more than a few bad apples, and I think there's been several reports that have pointed that out. The FBI Inspector General report in May pointed out hundreds of cases of abuse just witnessed by FBI agents. So it's more than a few bad apples, and we do ourselves no service within the military to deny that, and it doesn't help us to fix the problem.
And I want to get to your book and the real focus of the book, which is a shift in the way we conduct these interrogations that is, in fact, more efficacious, as you suggest in your book. But I have to ask you if you knew these abusive tactics were permitted on orders from the top, as this report finds. Did that part of the report surprise you?
No, I think when I looked back at Guantanamo Bay and what had happened there, when I read accounts from former interrogators and from an interpreter, you know, Eric Saar wrote a book about his experiences and what he saw as an interpreter about what was allowed, I instantly was repelled by these things. Waterboarding, I don't care where it's conducted or by whom, is torture, and it's un-American, as are the other practices that were used. To me, Geneva Convention is fairly specific, and even if it's not, and some people say, well, it's broad enough to allow these activities, those activities are certainly un-American. And I have an internal moral compass, having grown up in this country, to know the difference between right and wrong, and what's right and wrong.
And you've written, therefore, Matthew Alexander, this book, How to Break a Terrorist, the U.S. Interrogators Who Use Brains and Not Brutality to take down the Deadliest Man in Iraq. So let's talk about that specifically now. You were sent to Iraq in 2006. What were your orders, and how were you supposed to change the interrogation process, and why?
Well, my orders was to join a task force whose specific mission it was to find Zarqawi and to eliminate him. We believed at that time that he was behind, well, we know that he was behind the suicide bombings and that he was behind the bombing of the Golden Mosque that started the Civil War. And it was believed that if we could take him out, that we could slow the suicide bombings and stop the country from sliding into civil war. My group of interrogators, what we brought that was different is that we were composed of several criminal investigators from the Air Force. And so we had all these skills that we'd been using for years in criminal investigations that were based on relationship building, rapport, and other techniques that we use day-to-day while conducting investigations. And so we use those techniques, which are non-coercive, perfectly ethical, to great success in Iraq by applying them in the interrogation booth.
And you write about these non-violent interrogation techniques that were not new to you, but marked a departure from tactics used at Abu Ghraib. Can you say a bit more about what those techniques were, the innovative techniques that you employed, and why they worked?
Sure. I give the first story of the first interrogation that I conducted in Iraq was with a man named Abu Ali. And this was a man who was caught blessing suicide bombers. He was a Sunni Iraqi who had joined al-Qaeda because he needed protection from the Shia militias. The first thing he ever said to me was, if I had a knife, I'd cut your throat. And within a matter of 3 days, my partner and I were able to convince him to start cooperating with us and provide us the locations of al-Qaeda safe houses, one of which led to the man who eventually led us to Zarqawi. But that change came because of a few things. I built a relationship with him based on rapport. I actually apologized to him for the mistakes that America had made at the beginning of the war. And then I reached out to him in a spirit of friendship and told him that we could work together, Sunnis and Americans, to build a better Iraq. And those are the type of techniques based on relationship building, rapport, intellect, the strengths of American culture, if you will, that are most effective in the interrogation booth.
So your interrogation tactics are all about understanding the motivations behind those that participate in al-Qaeda and commit terrorist acts, is that right?
It's absolutely vital that we understand each person as an individual and that we not stereotype them and label them as al-Qaeda fanatics. These are people who have decided to join al-Qaeda for a variety of reasons. As I describe in the book, the story of General George Casey, who was commander of forces in Iraq, he came to my prison, and I told him this exact thing. These aren't all al-Qaeda ideologists. Sunni Iraqis are moderates in their views, and we can reach out to them. We can work with them. And a year later, General David Petraeus came in, reached out to Sunni Iraqis, facilitated the Anbar Awakening, and lo and behold, violence dropped dramatically all across Iraq.
Well, what were you able to learn about the rationale of what often seems, at least from afar, like irrational behavior? And what were you able to share with our military leaders?
Well, I think that, you know, I'd never discount the fact that there are some extremely radical members of al-Qaeda. And I describe in the book some of the acts that they carried out and how horrendous they were and how affected we were by that. However, despite whatever actions our enemies took, I told my team, and we were all committed to this, we would not change who we were as Americans. We would adhere to American principles. There were times when we watched videos of beheadings and then had to go in and interrogate the person who had committed the act. But it never changed who we were. And so I think it's an important point for American people to understand. Not only is this about morality, but pragmatically, torture is costing us American lives. It has in the past. Number one reason foreign fighters gave for coming to Iraq to fight was because of Abu Ghraib and because of the torture at Guantanamo Bay. And so our torture policy has cost us American lives, and it's counterproductive to winning this war.
And yet, your book's release date was delayed because the Department of Defense insisted on redacting unclassified information. You had to file a federal lawsuit against DOD, and there are still a lot of blacked-out passages in the book. Are they censoring you? Is it some kind of retribution for speaking out against these harsh interrogation techniques?
I believe it's both. I believe it's both an attempt at censorship and at retaliation. In fact, there was 93 items redacted from my book, and when I filed my appeal and used my lawsuit to back up my appeal, they acquiesced on 80 of them. And I don't think that's incompetence. I think that's a deliberate attempt at censorship, especially since they had redacted originally the entire chapter in which I convinced a person, the man Abu Hayder, to give us Zarqawi using non-coercive techniques. proving that our greatest success in this war has come using non-coercive techniques.
I do have a question, Matthew, from Catherine in Rockville. Would you like to see Rumsfeld and or President Bush criminally charged for torture?
Well, I don't comment on the accountability issue solely because of the fact that I'm still in the reserves. However, I know that interrogators, when they cross the line and break the law, they are held accountable.
As we have seen. Well, then let's look ahead. What do you expect out of the Obama administration in dealing with the closing of Guantanamo Bay as a detention center and with interrogation practices in general?
I think that President-elect Obama is within perhaps the first day of office, if not within the first week, is going to outlaw torture across all agencies of government. And I think it's important to understand that this is going to make America safer. This is going to seriously hurt al-Qaeda's ability to recruit fighters. And it's also going to allow interrogators to be more effective in the interrogation booth and to get information that will allow us to keep the country safer.
Matthew Alexander, thank you so much for being with us. Matthew Alexander is the author of How to Break a Terrorist. We appreciate your joining us this
morning. Thank you for having me, Jamie.
I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Coco Fusco is joining me now to give a different take on this. Coco Fusco is a performance artist, author of several books, and the chair of the Fine Arts Department at Parsons at the New School. After the Abu Ghraib scandal, she launched a performance and video project called Operation Aerotropos, in which she and some of her students were trained as interrogators in an effort to understand the psychology and experience of the role that a U.S. interrogator was now meant to fill. Coco, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, I guess you were able to listen to some of that conversation, and I would ask you to react, if you would, to some of what you heard from that other point of view. He gets inside the mind of the terrorist. You got inside the mind of the interrogator.
Well, first I'd like to say that I have a lot of respect for Mr. Alexander. I respect the fact that it's been interrogators and other people within the military who have been very important protagonists in the public criticism of torture methods used by U.S. forces and U.S. agents. And I have a lot of respect for them for speaking out. That's not an easy thing to do when you're in the military or when you work for the government. I also want to say that I'm not in disagreement with Mr. Alexander on many points. I agree with him that we shouldn't torture. I agree with him that interrogators can get information without physically hurting people. And I agree that there are methods that are in accordance with international human rights law that can be used in a time of war and that have been used in a time of war. That said, I think we differ a little on some things that have to do with history and context. One thing is that I think it's actually inaccurate to say that building rapport and using nonviolent methods is new. I actually think that that's very old.
Well,
and I think that
let me interrupt you there, because I do think that Matthew acknowledged that it's old. It was just new to some of the folks at Abu Ghraib. And it gives me a good opportunity to ask you specifically, and I think this is where you were going, Coco, when you began your project and you focused on getting inside the minds of these interrogators, what did you learn? And did you find that something shifted within you once you were put in that role of the interrogator?
Well, I think that there are a lot of things that I learned. I learned about how difficult it is to interrogate well. I learned how frustrating it can be when you have a prisoner who doesn't want to cooperate, and how an untrained person who also doesn't have good impulse control could easily resort to mistreatment of a prisoner because you have total power over them in the interrogation booth. And you know, and we even well-trained soldiers are human beings, and if you're in the room with somebody who's done violence to your friends, it's very hard to control control yourself. And if you're in an atmosphere where violence is condoned and where people are looking the other way or where you're being egged on, it can even get worse. Yes, all those things are things that I learned from the training experience that I had with Team Delta, but I also learned in the classroom with the former interrogators who worked with me about the history of techniques. And that's why I'm saying, you know, Americans have been fascinated by nonviolent forms of mind control in military situations since at least the Second World War. And I learned in the classroom with the interrogators who taught me about really great British interrogators and spies who extracted information from people using exactly the same methods that Mr. Alexander describes, making friends. Now, the difference in the current situation is that Mr. Alexander focuses exclusively on what interrogators do in the booth. And that's not the whole story of interrogation, and that's where I think we differ. There are long periods in between those visits to the booth, the interrogation booth, where there are military police and other soldiers doing a real number on many of the prisoners, and that directly impacts on what happens in the booth. So you can't take that part away. You can't say just because you make friends with somebody in the booth, that's better than beating them up in the booth. They might be getting beat up outside. They also might have had restricted access to food. They may not have gotten a lot of sleep over long periods of time. In other words, there's lots of other things that non-interrogators do to the prisoners while they're being held that affect the behavior of prisoners in the booth, and he's not focusing on that. So I think that's an important point where we differ.
I think it's a terrific point to end on. Folks can get the book, Matthew Alexander's How to Break a Terrorist, and consider Coco Fusco's critique of that book as well as her interesting work on the subject. Coco, thank you so much for being with us. I'm Jamie Floyd, in for Brian Lehrer. Up next, what to tip in these cash-strapped times. Give us a call, 212-433-9692.